Hello, I'm Michael Williams, and welcome to Blueprint for Living. And coming up on the show this week, we're auditing the creative stature of architecture, the whole profession. There's some suggestion that increasingly, architecture is seen as a status symbol for the well-to-do. More flashy public statement than anything to do with everyday life. We'll see. We head down south, far, far south to Antarctica. Helene Young tells us how the great expanse of ice changed her life. Plus reviews, olive bottling, and Tim Entwistle's making the shift from botanist to art critic. He's looking at the role of illusion in the garden.
One particular job that I did over in the United States, the owners had moved to Florida, to Palm Beach, and they were missing their herbaceous borders they had in New Jersey, so I painted them.
And Susan Mousehart's back with another cultural trend she thinks is past its use-by date. She's farewelling stuff. Inside, outside, upside down, so much to talk about. Do stick with us. Generally speaking, when you say that someone's job is a walk in the park, you're suggesting that there's not much to it, that it's a bit easy. But when you're talking about almost 2,000 parks and responsibility for those parks, it's a whole different ballgame. Our guest this morning is Mitch Silver. He's the Parks Commissioner for New York, and he's in Australia as part of the planning conference that's going on in Melbourne at the moment. Mitch, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
New York City of Parks, that is quite an awesome responsibility.
It is. But when you have a city as dense as New York, parks become the outdoor living room, and everybody uses them for different reasons. We have small apartments, and so those parks really serve as the lifeblood of the livability of our city.
I mean, they're obviously the big and famous parks of New York City, but one of the things that struck me the first time I went there was you round a corner and each little triangle has a park, a little fenced-off area, which are being used by people all the time. It's amazing.
Yes, because of our large population, we do have our destination parks, our neighborhood parks, but then they have the smaller parks and playgrounds. Because of our density, we need those parks to feel alive, to go outdoors, whether you're a senior citizen, a family, or a child. It really is just an essential part of New York City.
Now, we were talking a bit off air, and you were telling me you grew up in a part of Brooklyn right near Prospect Park. For listeners who don't know the area, describe that park and how it triggered your passion.
Well, it's one of the largest parks in Brooklyn. It is designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, so it's a very famous park, and it's been there for several hundred years. Growing up two blocks away from Prospect Park really anchored my childhood. I learned how to really ride my bike in that park, went on one of my first dates in that park. But having that beautiful park with lakes and ice skating rinks and just beautiful trees and vegetation really helped me grow up as a child. That's where I really learned to appreciate the outdoors.
I love it. So you found your vocation riding around, kind of going off track and finding the little corners of the park no one else knew.
I had no idea when I reflect back. And to go back to that park now as Parks Commissioner and having access to parts I never knew even existed, it is really a privilege.
One of the challenges of being a Parks Commissioner for a city like New York is that each separate borough, each separate block has its own identity. You know, it's not this kind of monolithic culture there. It's thousands of different ones. How do you handle that in assessing the different needs of different parks?
Well, typically, the life cycle of a park in terms of renewing some of the play equipment or features is about 20 years. So when we're about to redesign a park, we work very closely with the community. Demographics change, ages change, needs change. And so we're always seeing what we need to do to revitalize the park. Cricket, soccer is now growing sports in our city. We always look for opportunities to change our parks to adapt to the changing demographics, but also create play equipment. Right now we're exploring more creative play, less on the play units and more free play, artificial turf, walking tracks. So we make sure that we really adapt it to the 21st century and not stuck in a Robert Moses era of parks.
Mitch, I've got to stop you for a second because I want to know whether you just modified what you said for an Australian audience. Is cricket really a thing in the parks of New York?
Actually, it is. We have a huge West Indian population, and they love cricket. So we're adapting some of our fields. Again, it's location. So in Queens, where we have a huge West Indian population, Caribbean population, and Brooklyn, we now have a big demand for cricket, and we actually have leagues. So the answer is yes.
Wow. Once upon a time, that would have been kind of unthinkable.
Well, that's the beauty of being a city where you welcome immigrants. We're very open to new sports, and as even what we call our tier two sports, sports that just evolve from other countries, and we test them out to see where it will work in our park system and then put in a pilot field to see how it works to see if we want to replicate it other places.
What's the relationship between kind of shifting demographics in the city and kind of class in particular and parks? Are parks a great kind of demographic leveler, or are they are they different in privileged areas to the way they are in non-privileged?
Well, certainly it is democratic space. Central Park, whether you're rich or poor, you can go in that park and enjoy all the beautiful assets. But we do have some disparities in our city. Central Park, the High Line, Prospect Park, and some others do have conservancies and very affluent supporters that help those parks. We're trying to level the playing field. The Mayor de Blasio released an initiative called One NYC, and it's really to start to create park equity so that all parks throughout our city get the same level of attention and investment. So we do recognize there's a disparity, but this mayor and this administration is working to address that.
An earlier administration, namely the Giuliani one, was kind of most famous for its attempts to clean up New York, and safety and security in the streets and the parks would have been a big part of that. How much is safety a consideration?
Our parks are very safe. In fact, I say our parks are sometimes safer than some of our streets. They've changed over time. Because these are such cherished destinations, we have so many community partners that watch after the park. We're improving in terms of lighting, what we call sight lines, elevate the canopy so people can see in, but also improving the parks. So safety is not a really a big issue in our parks. And so that's the good thing about New York changing. It's now the safest big city in America, and that's reflected in our park system as well.
Is there a push to novelty and gimmickry when it comes to parks? I mean, the High Line has been an enormous success and really transformed that neighbourhood. But I was reading a story the other week about a floating park off in one of the rivers. I mean, is there a sense that you have to be breaking new ground, or can it be a nice, simple couple of benches, a nice tree?
Well, the beautiful thing about our park system is that you want to provide different experiences for different users. You want some of the formal parks, the active parks, the passive parks, some in Manhattan, some that, let's just say, have a lot more amenities than others. What's nice about it is that it gives people choices. If you want to go to the new floating pier park on the Hudson River, west side of Manhattan, once it's built, you can go there. You can go to the High Line, Central Park, or some of the smaller parks. That's what we want to do, provide different experiences for New Yorkers and visitors so that they have choices they can go to. So we allow creativity in our parks.
I was interested to read an interview with you, and you were talking about Bryant Park, which is very midtown Manhattan, and a park that was once very rough and kind of forbidding and is now a lovely, relaxed space. And the thing that I loved in that interview was that you described having movable chairs be a feature of the park. And you're a bit surprised by the way people chose to use those chairs. Can you expand on that?
Yes. This was an experiment now that's being replicated really all over the city and the country. It gives people choice. They pick the location, the experience, whether it's two people, one person. They choose a location to enjoy themselves. But there's been an evolution. People used to go there as groups, two or three people to go there for lunch. Now, with the advent of the mobile phone, people are actually going there by themselves, finding a corner under a tree, and they're lost in their emails, in their text messaging. So even technology is changing the use of the park, but the fact that they have movable chairs, that people can self-select their experience, makes that park very, very successful.
I love that kind of sad image of a whole lot of people sitting on their own in a park looking at their phones. But you make that possible. There's free Wi-Fi in that park. I mean, it's you recognize the way in which people want to use it, and you try to respond to that. Do you? I know you have to be impartial and, you know, not have favorites, but do you have a favorite kind of secret little corner of New York where there's a park that you think gets it right?
I've been asked that question a lot, and like I'm a father, all my parks are my favorites. Each park has certain emotional attachments. Clearly, Prospect Park, where I grew up, is special to me. Central Park, which is everyone's favorite park, where I work right now, my office is in Central Park, is also one of my favorites. The High Line, a three-dimensional experience that anyone who comes to New York, they must experience. But I'd have to say Inwood Park near the Cloisters is one of those special parks. I went on many dates with my wife there. So for me, it's quite special. It's tucked away, overlooking the Hudson River, dramatic views, Heather Gardens, and then approaching the Cloisters and Museum is just a romantic experience. So I'd have to say Inwood is certainly a special one to me.
Mitchell, I love not only have you got your career out of parks, but that's the second reference to dates in parks. It's clearly your MO. You take them and show them what's there.
Our goal is to keep people happy and falling in love, and parks are one of those destinations. People get engaged there and married there.
Well, the way in which a park enlivens a city, you've illustrated beautifully today. Just before we go, I have to ask, is being Parks Commissioner anything like the television show Parks and Recreation, or is it more like The Wire? Is it kind of inter-scene politics? Are you fighting people?
I would say it's a combination of the two. It is certainly entertaining. Each day has its own set of challenges, humor and excitement. And politics, being New York, is certainly part of it. So it's a nice combination. No day is the same. And New York is always a city that's full of surprises.
Well, I've been speaking with Mitch Silver, Parks Commissioner from New York City. Thanks so much for joining me in the studio today, Mitch.
Thank you so much, Michael. My pleasure.
You're listening to Blueprint for Living here on RN with me, Michael Williams. Coming up, we're going to drill down into architecture. Is it a profession that's lost its luster? All that and more coming up soon.
Blueprint Reviews.
Okay, it's time again to catch up on those crucial cultural moments that you might have missed. A little bit of cinema and a little bit of literature just to get you going. And to kick us off this morning, we have RN's very own Jason DeRosso. Jason, what have you brought us this morning?
This morning I brought you All Is Lost, which was a film from 2013 starring Robert Redford and no one else, basically. I mean, this is a film with one actor on screen about a lone yachtsman who finds himself in trouble at sea after his boat collides with a stray shipping container. And from this one mishap, the film is a kind of series of misfortunes with Robert Redford's character, who's given the credit only of our man in the end credits of the film. He's basically scrambling to reverse the bad luck, but it's kind of a slightly mad scramble that's actually pretty futile, as it turns out. But an austere film in a sense, because there's no dialogue in it at all. It begins with a kind of slightly apologetic letter read out in voiceover to presumably some loved ones, but we don't know much about him. There's no flashbacks to family life or to kind of any sort of professional life. We just get this sense that, hey, it's Robert Redford on screen. The guy's well-groomed. He looks like a fairly moneyed kind of white North American guy. He has a wedding ring on, and that's about it. I mean, presumably he has the kind of resources, both economic and sort of temporal, to allow himself this kind of folly of going around the world on quite a well-appointed yacht alone. But beyond that, we don't really know. And so it becomes, I think as it unfolds, well, we can project various things onto this movie, but how it sort of plays to me is this sort of critique of a particularly kind of masculine hubris.
Jason, I like Robert Redford and masculine hubris as much as the next person. Obviously, you know, that's how I spend my weekends, consuming both. But really, I've seen the trailer for this a few times, and I can't quite imagine being in the mood to sit and watch Robert Redford for an hour and a half, not talk to anyone, and be knocked around on a boat. What gives it a drive?
It is just so wonderfully compelling. I spoke to the director, J.C. Chandor, when it came out, and he said that he took, structurally, he took his inspiration from action movies, and in particular, Die Hard. I don't know if you're familiar with that film, but starring Bruce Willis, great film. And so he carefully structured his film around the kind of lulls and crisis moments and sort of suspenseful crescendos that a film like Die Hard is full of. So even though on the surface it does seem like this kind of austere exercise, no dialogue, one guy on screen, it does end up being this very compelling, intricately plotted, but incredibly sort of cinematic and almost purist exercise. So I loved it.
Thanks for that, Jason.
You're
also joined this morning by John Page from Pages and Pages. John, what should we be reading?
I've got today the Everything I Never Told You by Celeste Ng, which is an incredible exploration of grief, family and identity and the pressures and expectations that come from each of those. And the book opens with the death of Lydia Lee, who's the middle child of Marilyn and James. James Lee is from Chinese background. Marilyn is not. When they were married in the 1950s in America, their relationship was quite controversial at the time. Marilyn was ostracized by her mother over the marriage. And James is a professor of American history. He's always strived to try and fit into America. And Marilyn was a gifted scientist who gave up that career, gave up academic studies to start a family. And as we kind of explore the death of Lydia, what they didn't know about their daughter kind of starts kind of bubbling through the surface, and you start to kind of explore the kind of the fractured relationships within this family. But you also kind of start to see the expectations that each parent had on their children. So for James, he expects his children, who are now kind of second generation Chinese American, to not have the same pressures and the same kind of difficulties he experienced fitting in. And for Marilyn, she wants her children to, you know, pursue the academic studies that she forego. So as you're going to get to know Lydia, and the story kind of jumps around between the present and the aftermath of the death. You go back in time and we meet Lydia when she was still alive. We also kind of jump into the future as well. But we kind of see what these expectations and the weight of them and what they've done to this whole family. And then there's the mystery element of what's led up to Lydia's death and who's been involved and what's led to this tragedy.
So, John, this sounds like it's kind of almost diametrically opposed to Jason's pick. Rather than a one-hander, this is a kind of complicated family drama. How does it do it? Does it move from character to character, or is it all a kind of omniscient third-person narration?
It's a really intricate chronology. So Celeste Ng kind of does jump between each character. You get flashbacks of both of James and Marilyn. You get the sibling story as well. So Lydia's younger sister Hannah has quite a kind of intricate part in the story. But being younger, she witnesses things from a different perspective. Lydia's older brother Nathan also has kind of some of the same experiences and the pressures that Lydia's experienced as well, but handled them in different ways. And she really kind of jumps around. As I said, kind of you get flashbacks. Flashbacks to the past, you get the story in the present where they're trying to find out, you know, the police are investigating how Lydia's died. Then again, you kind of jump well into the future and to see what's happened to the family down the track. So it's kind of very non-linear in the way she tells it, but it could be very confusing, but Celeste is very skilled in kind of giving you that insight and letting you know exactly where you are within the chronology of the story.
It sounds both big and ambitious, and yet at the same time with the kind of intimacy of all good family dramas.
Yes, but it's not a big read either. It's only about 250 pages, so it's something, you know, it's not a big tome either. She kind of packs all this in to kind of quite kind of stark prose.
Thanks for that, John. That's an important disclaimer with these big American family sagas. So not too much to get through, but definitely worth catching up with. Celeste Ng's Everything I Never Told You, available from all good bookshops. And Jason's pick, All Is Lost, is available on video on demand platforms. You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN, Radio Australia and the ABC Radio app. I'm Michael Williams.
Well, when you were young, did you ever watch The Addams Family?
No, I was watching Happy Days. Explain more, Scott.
Well, there was always that moment when Gomez would turn to his gorgeous wife, Morticia, and say, "Oh, Tish, when you speak French, it drives me wild." Well, you've driven me a bit wild. You invited me to get all Aristotelian.
Yeah, but you didn't do it in Greek. I was really disappointed.
Yes, but I was wearing the robes.
Waleed Ali and Scott Stevens, The Minefield. Today, 1:30, here on RN.
So from film and TV and books to get into the great outdoors, it's time to head out to the garden. But it's not an opportunity this week to get our hands dirty. Blueprint's resident botanist and director of the Royal Botanic Gardens Melbourne, Tim Entwistle, is looking at some gardens where creative license is being used to create a space as much centred around illusion as around nature itself. Trompe l'œil quite literally means trick of the eye. It's the artistic practice that's all about the delight of illusion. And Tim is talking to artist and creative gardener Nobby Seymour about just that.
Now, Nobby, you create all kinds of art, and these days a lot of what you do would probably I'd call abstract, but I'm a botanist, remember, but you also create almost the opposite, and these are landscapes that trick us into thinking they're real. Not just any landscape, but these are gardens. We're looking at in front of us here some photographs and images and pictures of, well, they look like gardens. What are they?
Trompe l'œil, which I started painting in about 1984. And usually architects and designers came to me and they said, can you do anything with this space? It's not working within the volume of the building. And quite often I found the solution was through this illusion, this garden scene. And sometimes that was extending the garden into the context of a garden that already existed. The trick was to keep it fairly banal almost, because if you were in a Melbourne suburban home and there was the Pacific Ocean and palm trees down the end of the passage, you tended to realise that you were being had.
but do most people actually want to make the garden look a little bit more exotic than they could perhaps grow there anyway?
Yes, I think so. One particular job that I did over in the United States, the owners had moved to Florida, to Palm Beach, and they were missing their herbaceous borders they had in New Jersey, so I painted them. It was too hot in Florida to grow a herbaceous border, but anyway, thanks to me, they've now got one.
So this is almost, instead of getting a hothouse or instead of moving house, you can actually create a garden that you couldn't normally have there. The pictures are lovely here, and there are some fantastic plants in there too, and you've created not just gardens, but you look off into mountains in some of them too. So that's part of it as well, I guess, is a landscape as much as a garden setting.
Yes, sometimes I kept the landscape very literal, and other times I could be quite fanciful so that there was the possibility to look out into sort of dreamy landscapes with mountains in the distance. Often I frame them by the foliage of Australian trees, usually Australian trees, sometimes European.
Are plants easy to represent, or are they a bit like faces? I had my father was an artist, and he used to say my face was difficult to paint, so he always painted my brother's instead. So are some plants difficult to paint?
Yes, and it was very interesting because the early Australian painters painted the Australian trees through European eyes. I had a problem the other way around. I grew up in red gum country, and when I started painting elm trees, European deciduous trees, for example, I tended to make them look like red gums. So, but I quite agree with you, Tim. Trees do have their own sort of persona and a certain imprimatur about them that give them a certain look.
And your background actually is as an architect. You trained as an architect, and you talk about each plant having its own look and feel, I suppose. Is there a style and an architecture, if you like, to each of the plants as well?
Very much so. We were out in the back garden before, and we were admiring a fig that had sort of self-sown, and I explained how I loved the fig because it was exploring space, and then we looked at a succulent, which had almost was defending itself against the space. So they both expressed these two very different personalities, which I think we both found quite charming.
Now, just talk me through a couple of the pictures we have in front of us now, just if you could describe a few of these landscapes. There's one right in the middle here, which is very classical as well. I mean, you're almost using trees here like columns and making it look like it's a building. Just explain that one to me.
Yes, that was actually commissioned by a well-known nursery way back in the 80s. And the lady who owned the nursery in High Street, she wanted a backdrop for showing all her pot plants and whatever. So I painted this landscape, which had two sort of needle obelisks on the side. There's a tree form, which was espaliated, forming a view through to a somewhat idyllic, romantic landscape with a little sign which read in Kafkaesque way, I think, saying, kindly do not tread on the landscape, because it had this path leading into the landscape. So it's just to deter people from walking into the illusion.
That's beautiful. We have lovely signs in Botanic Gardens saying, please walk in our grass in Australia. Because overseas you're not allowed to walk on the grass. And there are other pictures here too with some Australian images as well and birds too. Is there another one here you might just pick out for us?
This is a job I did in Sydney, for example, and we're looking out onto here I've continued the floor. It was actually in a corridor leading to a lift in a private home. And I've carried the floor through into this illusion, this trompe l'œil, and you can stand out on this terrace outside, which is underneath the branches of a Tristania conferta or Queensland brush box, which were lining the streets of this particular part of Sydney, and enjoy a really spectacular view of Sydney Harbour without too much building in it.
Yeah, so it's like there is a door painted on there, you can see outside, but of course it's all an illusion. There is a lot of this work going outdoors. A lot of the big cities around the world, you see these pictures on the side of buildings of sort of false windows, and that's a more modern take on it. Because I was about to say, is this something that perhaps is a romantic period that we've now passed?
I think it was a zeitgeist in a way that it swept through the world in the late 70s, 80s, and by the 90s it was perhaps starting to die out. And it ended up being done by a lot of people and not always done terribly well. I think that a certain element of the trompe-l'œil is that it had to have a visual wit to it, and if you didn't have that visual wit element, the trompe started to fall flat on its face.
What is the survival rate of these, either in private houses or publicly? Because they are, I mean, once you put something on a wall, it is riskier.
Yes, it is risky, and look, a lot of them have gone to God, so to speak, but there is a certain risk involved in painting things directly on walls. But I'm very pleased to say that the State Library have now taken possession of all my photo records and so on, so that'll go into the archives at the State Library, so they will live on in one way or another.
Thanks, Nobby Seymour, for letting me into your garden, both real and imagined. I'm Tim Entwistle for RN.
That's the apparently hard-to-paint Tim Entwistle there. He was talking with artist and gardener Nobby Seymour about the fake outdoors. You're listening to Blueprint for Living on RN and Radio Australia with me, Michael Williams. Still to come, I'm going to get some advice on some slower-burn paths to deliciousness, from bottling olives to slow cooking. But before we get there, it's time to talk architecture. Everybody loves an architect. I mean, let's face it, it's one of the great glamour professions. There's a recent study in the US that identified that architect was up there as one of the most common jobs held by love interests in romantic comedies. Like, they're all journalists and architects. That was what you wanted to aspire to. But even if architects are hot stuff, there's a suggestion that the gloss may have come off the profession itself, or at least architecture as an art form. There's a panel discussion being held later today as part of this week's Australian Institute of Architects conference, and it suggests there's a real problem. Moderating what promises to be a fiery session is publisher, writer and architecture commentator Andrew McKenzie, and one of his lineup for that discussion is Deborah Saunt. She's co-director of a London-based architectural practice, and they both joined me in the Melbourne studio this morning. Hello to you both.
Hi.
Morning.
Okay, Andrew, I'm going to start with you because you're the moderator. I've got to ask, is this just a hollow provocation to keep a conference lively, or is there a real relevance problem for the cultural and artistic reputation of architecture?
I think there's a profound challenge for the role of architecture in the community and in the culture. And I think that if you look back over previous decades and going back to, say, to the post-war years, the place that the architect had in society as a public intellectual was profoundly important. They regularly met with prime ministers and they regularly met with senior decision makers and captains of industry, and they were taken very seriously on all things. And I think that a number of things have happened in recent years that partly is to do with a kind of a celebrity status that may have attached to some aspects of design. It's partly to do with this changing kind of contract environment which the architect has to work in. A number of factors have conspired, and I think it has created something of an existential challenge, you might say, for the role of the architect. Not simply as a service provider, another person making hospitals and another person making office buildings, but as somebody who is a significant part of the culture, as a novelist or a musician is, in the way that, you know, people really think of novelists and musicians as somehow representing and framing their world. And I wonder sometimes whether there's a challenge in the profession as how they, you know, stay at that table.
It's such an interesting idea. I mean, it's hard to, if we separate out the notion of architecture as an art form, it's hard to think of any other art form that's as subject to the whims of planners and bureaucrats, and the relationship between vision and implementation is as compromised, perhaps.
For sure, and yet the irony there is that there's pretty much no other form of cultural expression that is as visible and as permanent as a piece of architecture. So, you know, you can't think of a building that's going to be 40 stories high and it's going to be sitting looking at people for the next generation as being anything other than a commitment to the public space of the city. And that is a really important form of expression. And I think too often that just gets dumbed down to what's the cost to deliver it and what's the minimum standards we can to make it, and maybe let's put a facade on it that makes it kind of animated. But actually, in terms of that really having a serious cultural piece of communication, I think we sometimes lose sight of that.
Deborah, what do you think about Andrew's provocation? Existential crisis? Are you feeling it?
Well, personally, not at all, because I'm an architect who's probably had the revelation come to me in the last few years that, in fact, I do have a role as an architect to have a public voice. And I've found myself up until quite recently sort of being embarrassed, being invited by people like Kevin MacLeod to talk about architecture to a popular audience. And that's really made me aware of the kind of distance that needs to be breached by architects to enable their way of communicating to the world, to sort of, you know, really emphasise this, the significance and relevance of what they do.
So how do you see the kind of rise of the I know the bit of terminology I'm always awkward saying, it's star architect culture, that star architect who does the big iconic statement building that's as much about impact and legacy as it is about function. Do you think that's a positive move for the profession of architecture?
Well, I think the star architect is the kind of product of a kind of product-driven culture. We're consuming architecture now rather than experiencing it, and CEOs and, you know, captains of industry or cultural institutions looking for their own significance are kind of buying a brand. And I think that's fine within that sort of rhetoric. But what's being lost definitely within the discourse is the idea of what is good for the city. And architects seem to have surrendered that. I think there's been a lot of fear and suspicion since the 60s and the demise of the big modern master plan, you know, of kind of great big pioneering new towns, of maybe we shouldn't be doing things on that scale. But architects really should be inserting themselves into the process. And for example, working on great public realm projects to connect great pieces of architecture as well as the objects themselves that they make.
But we still, at least in Australia, have kind of key government roles for architects. You know, we have a state architect, we have a, you know, there is a sense that they should be at the centre of these discussions about what our cities need and what they need to look like. Do you think that doesn't happen as much as it should, Andrew?
No, I think the rise of the government architects from state to state has been one of the great things that has happened in the last few years, and I think their role has been really important. The conference was, in fact, launched by the Minister for Planning, who made an announcement to say that the OVGA, the Office of the Victorian Government Architect, was being pulled back to the Office of the Premier and Cabinet, not taken out of the Finance Department. And I think we all read that as placing it back in a very prominent position of strategic design thinking around the city. So I think that's absolutely the case. But I would also say that these are great examples of things that can make the world better. But at the same time, we'd be lying not to say that things like, not to get too technical, novated contracts where the architect is no longer contracted necessarily to the client, but is contracted, say, to the builder or to the developer. And the builder and developer may not necessarily have a 20, 30-year spectrum of where they see the value in the project. So we have the strange thing of a building that's going to last for a generation, but the person effectively being the client may not be interested. And they're not all. Sometimes there are good developers, of course. But I think when you look at the broad landscape of how buildings get done, other than the house, other than the private house, when a medium to large size project gets done, there are some very fundamental instruments in place as to how it gets procured, how decisions get made, that somehow sideline this larger role of architecture as a part of the public discourse of what our culture is. I should say that one of the reasons why we invited Deborah across and a number of the architects were to bring architects who, as you say, Deborah, who have a public voice and who are positioning themselves in a different form. And we do want the conference, in a sense, to be that kind of inspiration where there are ways to recoup some of that value.
So, Deborah, building on that, I mean, is there a sense that you find that the architectural imperative is often at odds with a commercial one or a corporate one?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we've worked on projects where we're part of a logistical supply chain. Yeah. And it's a wonderful pyramid with all sorts of kind of quality control and cost assessments, and design is on the bottom line. It's really not at the heart of what's going on. So I think coming here has been a really good point of reflection to find out what the tactics are that one's using to kind of redefine the role of the architect, to in sort of put them back in the frame to sort of influence things.
I'm interested, moving away from the kind of city-sized scale for a moment, one of the kind of measures of how well architecture's reputation is going is at a domestic level and at a kind of everyday level. And there's an extent to which people working on building projects themselves, the use of an architect can be seen as a thing about status and about kind of money rather than an essential part of a building or development process. Andrew, have you seen a trajectory in people less likely to use architects for their own projects?
Well, I think that question kind of like is embedded in a larger question around how we control the built environment when it comes to houses. And I think if you look at any graph in terms of how long it takes to get a single building through planning, how much it costs to get through planning, how many documents and pieces of paper you have to go through, we have never seen a regulated environment like we have today. And I think one of the consequences of that is that if you do anything other than a default setting, cookie cutter, we've seen this building, you know, 100 times before, it does start to become complicated for all sorts of bureaucratic and regulatory reasons. And that is one of the inhibiting factors, sadly. So, yes, I mean, I think we still, the one place that architects certainly unambiguously have a place of value that everyone understands is in the home. And that's a great thing. That's a very important thing. But I think we also have to look at the other mechanisms by which we deliver the city and housing and realize that we need to make some really fundamental decisions around allowing innovation to take place, and how can we do that without it costing hundreds of thousands of dollars to get something through planning and the kind of the processes involved in that.
Deborah, you mentioned grand designs before. How much does that kind of popularization of thinking about questions of design and architecture make people think they can do it themselves or underestimate the value of professionals in the field?
I think those programs kind of hook into the fact that everybody has an innate sense of what design is, and that it goes beyond need and shelter, and that this issue of beauty is really, really important. I think what's missing are maybe the stepping stones to actually kind of linking that desire with the appointment of an architect. You know, what is involved? Maybe we need to do more to kind of explain how architects can help you save money. They might have a fee attached to them, but they can, you know, be deployed to provide really good value. And I think you can find examples here in Melbourne of architects who are coming up with really new ways of making buildings like the Commons by Breathe architecture, where they've actually questioned what's in the house, what's in the apartment. They've made it $60,000 cheaper. And they're actually demonstrating that architects can bring beauty and good value together. So spreading that sort of the fact that that's possible is really important.
Certainly one thing I would say, talking about residential design, is that we are in Australia kind of reaching that tipping point where quite soon the majority of new homes will not be houses, they will be apartments. And I think in the context of regulation, how you do large buildings, I think architects have an opportunity to reinsert them, like Jeremy McLeod and Breathe Architecture have done, to reinsert them into that role within multi-residential projects, to say we're not just going to do some extrusion of space that fits the minimum qualities of a planning regulation, but actually, we are going to do something that the residents are going to live with happily for a long time.
You don't think there's a danger that apartment living is increasingly just leading to a cookie cutter approach to design when it comes to our residential living?
Well, I think so far there have been some pretty poor examples of that. And I think there is this kind of moment of shifting where people don't quite know how to yet insert themselves in there. But it's worth saying, since we've mentioned, you know, Breathe, they've created this model around where ethical investors can get involved in housing developments. And so far, within the space of a few months, 7 other developments of this sort within Melbourne are taking place. So I think there are new models evolving right as we speak.
Just before we finish up, and Deborah, you mentioned not wanting architects just to be seen as part of a supply chain. Well, how would you then reposition architects in terms of that perception? How can an architect be a problem solver, be an ingredient in trying to build a better city, a better society?
Well, I think Jean Gang puts it very well, who's a speaker, that in the role of the architect, we used to think of it just about buildings, but actually we're about designing the future. We work with structures, we work with systems, we work with long-term legacies and management and cost, and that actually we can come up, rather like you say, architect of the web. We really need to reclaim that role of, as somebody who can design really smart systems, not just beautiful objects.
Look, you've covered some fascinating territory. I'm not convinced that architects are anything other than glamorous, Andrew. But I like the provocation. I think there's lots more to discuss there. I've been speaking with publisher and writer Andrew McKenzie and London-based architect Deborah Saunt. They're in Melbourne for the National Architecture Conference, and that's being put on by the Australian Institute of Architects. It's on right now. Have you been involved in a building project that's decided not to engage an architect? Let us know. Keep the conversation going. Blueprint for Living can be found on Facebook, on Twitter as @RNBlueprint, and in its very own part of the ABC website. I don't want to talk about architecture, but you're probably better finding that via a search engine. We'd love to hear what you think. Still to come, we're going to hear from Susan Mousehart before we head out to Antarctica after the 10 o'clock news. Stay with us on RN, on Radio Australia, or on the internet, however you're joining us. Now, I know it's only May, but across the bottom half of the country, or at the very least in this part of the bottom half of the country, it's beginning to feel like winter is coming. Those long evening barbecues and salads are a distant memory. We're moving into the world of simmering pots on the stove and jars of things preserving and pickling before we set in for our hibernation. There are few people in the country better placed to illuminate this seasonal cook-up than the author of The Complete Slow Cooker and bottling and preserves aficionado, Sally Wise. She joins us down the line from Hobart. First seasonal things first then, Sally. I want to begin with bottling in general and olives in particular. I understand it's olive season out there.
It is olive season. The olives, even down here, are ripening. They're turning from green to violet and even heading towards black.
So how do you know an olive's ripe? Do you have to get it ripe before you even get started pickling, or can you do it somewhere at the halfway mark?
You can do them at the halfway mark. You can do them while they're still green. As they progress through to violet and black, well, then they're going to get a little less bitter. But you can virtually do them at any stage once they reach the right size, and we have tons and tons down here. Just beautiful.
I want you to talk me through the process, because every time I see olives on a tree, I think about how much I love them, and I feel so far removed from the possibility of turning them into something that I could eat. But just to kick off, am I right to feel like this time of year is a good time of year for bottling things?
It is. We've had the flush of summer with all those lovely berries and apricots and all those stone fruits, but now we're moving into those lovely earthy flavours like apples and quinces and pears, and of course olives come right along there as well, and we had grapes too. But all of these things, you know, they're just ripe for the picking, quite literally. And yes, get them into a bottle, capture them in a bottle, because often they're enhanced by that, and certainly they're like a toolbox in your pantry that you can use to enhance other dishes, or in their own right, they're delicious.
It feels like a tricky toolbox. Talk me through it. I've got my sterilised bottles lined up. I've got my olives that look utterly inedible.
Yes.
What do I do? How do I make magic?
Okay. Well, it's quite a process, and you know, in every culture, just about there's some where olives will grow, there's different processes, cultural processes for doing so, and then even within the cultures, there's almost neighbourhood recipes for doing them. But here's the general process. First, obviously, you're going to have to sort, clean them, wash them, and then now, unless they're very black, you're going to have to slice each olive. So you're going to have to be very patient, get a little sharp like paring knife, and put 2 cuts in each olive. You can imagine how that's going if you're going to have tons of them. About 6 millimetres deep on each side. Then you need to soak them in water. Now, you have to change that water every day. So you put them into a container, food safe, of course, and they must be submerged. So put a plate on top or a plastic bag filled with water tied at the top, anything like that. Leave it for 24 hours, drain it off, same process. Now, it will depend on your olives how long that will take, anything from 10 to 18 days. About 16 is probably good. And then you have to prepare a brine.
Wow.
To put them into. Yeah.
So you don't season that water for the soaking? That's just normal water?
It's just normal water, but it has to be changed every day. But then you have to prepare a brine. And that And now for each, I'll give you a ratio. For each kilo of olives, you'll need a litre of water, 100 grams of salt, and some people will even put in maybe 3/4 a cup of vinegar as well. Personally, I don't, but you just use the brine. So you have to weigh up your olives so you know how much you have, and then make up your brine accordingly. Bring that brine up to the boil, boil it for a couple of minutes, then cool it, and then pour that over your olives and make sure they're submerged, and then put about a quarter of an inch. I'm so old, I still talk in imperial. And what's that, about 6-8 millimetres, or a layer of oil over the top, cover it, and then leave them like that. And they'll have to be at probably 15 to 25 degrees, and you leave them there for at least a month. And then you can take them out and eat them. You may choose to put them into olive oil, but personally, I wouldn't do that with all of them, because you have to be very careful of botulism. So just take out like maybe 2 weeks worth, cover them with olive oil, pop them in the fridge.
I'm going to stop you just for a tick, Sally, because I have to say my first hesitation was going to be the length of time going on here, but then you dropped the botulism word and I had to kind of double check about that. Are there safety issues around olives? Are they tricky to keep?
Yes, because any vegetable doesn't have the acid to help it keep like the fruit will have. That's why some people put in some red wine vinegar as well, or any sort of vinegar, as an extra insurance. You know, you're pretty safe. This brine is fairly strong. You must handle them carefully. You must make sure you keep them under the right conditions. And when you finish, I mean, they're delicious, but don't expect them to be like the commercial ones that you buy. They're much firmer, al dente, to the tooth, whereas the store-bought, for want of a better word, olives are kind of softer, and that's because they are generally treated with lye or caustic soda.
So if consistency-wise they're going to be a little bit disconcerting, are there special things you add for taste? Do you favour any particular seasoning or accompaniments?
I like a little bit of chilli in there, you know, a little bit of bite for some interest, but you can add all sorts of things. You could add some allspice, you can add bay leaves, peppercorns, of course. It's just coriander seed, just depending on what sort of twist of flavour that you want yourself. It's quite a process, but we do this every year, and it's certainly worth it. You know, on a cheese platter, they are stunning. You can even make a kind of tapenade with them as well. So it's worth it when you have them growing free for the taking. Why wouldn't you really?
Well, why wouldn't you indeed? Months of work, tiny little incisions on olives, and then at the end you might get botulism. But why wouldn't you give it a try?
No, you won't get botulism because you'll be really careful.
Well, of course. That's right. You've definitely got my number there, Sally. I'm just curious, do you make olive oil ever? Do you make your own olive oil?
No, we don't make our. We get such exceptionally good olive oil in the valley where I live from producers. We did try this, and for some extraordinary amount of olives, we were able to extract about 60 mil of oil. It is not worth it unless you have all the proper equipment.
I'm not going to let you go. I'm thrilled by that olive bottling recipe that we will put up on our website. But I just want to, before I let you go, talk about slow cooking, because you're something of a slow cooking aficionado as well. And I'm a bit kind of overwhelmed by it and can't even work out where to start.
Really?
Do you have a tip for where I begin?
Yes. First, buy your slow cooker, and don't buy one that's too big. You know, some people buy, as indeed I have, a great big one, like 6.5 litre, and so they have to make a great deal of it, and then they get sick of the dish that they've made, and they think, oh, I'm not doing that again. Buy something that's 3.5 litre is good, to 4 litre or 4.5 maximum, and then you just start working with your slow cooker, and it's so simple. You just throw things. I don't worry about browning meats or anything like that. I just throw things in with some really nice ingredients, put the lid on, turn it on, and let it do its thing. It's one of the simplest things to do. I call it fast slow cooking because it's fast to prepare, slow to cook, and then at the end it's fast again in the dishing up when you come home.
I get really all kind simple. Of intimidated by things like the amount of liquid and everything else. Do you have to worry about getting these things precisely right?
No, precise is not a word that works well in my cooking vocabulary because there's always flexibility built in. You really don't need much more than a cup or a cup and a half of liquid in there, because what a slow cooker does, people say it makes its own liquid. That's not strictly true. What happens is that a seal is formed between the rim of the base, the ceramic insert, and the lid, and that seal is formed by steam, and so nothing is escaping. So all the liquid, all those lovely nutritious juices are kept within the slow cooker. Sally, so you only need a cup to a cup and a half of liquid.
Sally, you're getting me past my fear here. What's your favourite thing that you cook in the slow cooker, just before I let you go?
Laksa is good. People often say their favourite is a Tilly's Indian sweet curry beef. It dates back to hundreds of years ago. But my husband's favourite, I have to tell you, and you will not believe this, it's a lemon marshmallow meringue pudding cooked in slow cooker. It's absolutely delicious.
Oh, you have utterly inspired me. You're getting me past my fear. I'm going to try and work out if I can claim a slow cooker on my tax. It's been very
good
to talk to you today.
I do.
That's bottler and poster girl for patience, Sally Wise. Thank you so much for your time. Sally's the author of many books. Her most recent one is called Family Favourites, and it's published by ABC Books. Sally's own olive bottling recipe, as I said, is up on the Blueprint for Living, part of the RN website. Do try it and let us know what you think. Well, a little bit earlier in the show, we raised the spectre of the architecture profession losing its spot at the cultural high table. Maybe, maybe not, we're kind of undecided, but that's not the most brutal possible assessment. I reserve that category for Susan Mousehart's sweet obituaries to the sinking ships of culture. This week, she's taking on a big and sprawling subject. She's handling stuff.
Every once in a while, a book comes along that blows the dust off the nonfiction list and takes a crevice device to our cultural expectations. A few years back, it was Shannon Lush's Spotless, a book that celebrated the beauty and the terror of stain removal. It left an indelible impression. We were all pretty much swept up with it at the time. In fact, it became the number one best-selling book in Australia in 2006. Or I'm pretty sure it did. An editor's note on the book's Wikipedia entry states, "This article needs some cleanup." Apart from being a dirty great read, Spotless marked a watershed for a generation of women who'd grown up with feminism and learned to be rightly suspicious of the whole domestic mess. Well, this book made housewifery ideologically sound again. Of course, Nigella Lawson's How to Be a Domestic Goddess a few years earlier had cleared the way for kick-ass women to admit they still cared about pie crust. But it happens. Fast forward to 2015, and the newest blockbuster, The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying Up, the Japanese art of decluttering and organizing, which is to Lush and Lawson pretty much what Mrs. Beaton is to Hildegard of Bingen. The book, which has sold in the millions internationally since its launch late last year, is the handiwork of household ninja Marie Kondo, a childless 30-year-old whose method revolves around binning any and every household item which cannot honestly be said to spark joy. Nevertheless, I still have my copy. And my kids. Go figure. The book repeatedly hits that elusive sweet spot between wisdom and mental illness. With an authorial voice that's equal parts fairy godmother, head girl, and recovering opium eater. I loved it, and it scared the living crap out of me. There isn't the slightest irony in Kondo's promise that tidying, so-called, will trigger a cataclysmic spring cleaning of the soul. Nor is she being metaphysical when she speaks of the unhappiness of household clutter. In fact, she urges readers to empathize with their balled-up socks and underwear. "The time they spend in your drawer is their only chance to rest," she scolds. Well, that's wishful thinking. It's no wonder the book's attracted a cult following.
"Why, it's like a dream."
Kondo cheerfully admits that she's been obsessing over other people's clutter since she was in kindergarten. When the other children ran out to play, she'd stay inside compulsively, color-coding the plasticine and edging the grass on Hairy Harry. The poor kid never got the help she needed. On the brighter side, she did get a book contract. Kondo can hardly be held responsible for initiating the war on stuff. Decluttering has been a first-world problem since the dawning of this millennium, and a raft of highly paid consultants, reality TV shows, and books have littered our cultural shores for the past decade. James Wallman's Stuffication is one of them, and I recommend it for the title alone. So, yep, In theory, at least, stuff is officially done and dusted. And now, thanks to Kondo, rolled into a neat ball for vertical storage.
The irrepressible Susan Mousehart there. Welcome back to Blueprint for Living. I'm Michael Williams. And coming up later in the half hour, we're going to try to get to the bottom of why Australian bush foods and native ingredients, despite their champions and their well-established nutritional benefits, have struggled to penetrate mainstream culinary consciousness. Are they still the next big thing? Still? But before that, we're headed south, far, far south, and we may be sometime. It does seem remarkable to me that we've done several weeks of a segment devoted to places that change people's lives, and we're only now turning our attention to Antarctica. If you know anyone who's made that trip down there, you'll know that people who return from the southernmost continent tend to come back as complete zealots, armed with very lengthy slideshows. Our guest today is Helene Young, the Queensland Regional Flying Manager for QantasLink. That's right, she's got 260 pilots who report to her, but perhaps improbably she also moonlights. She's the author of 6 romance and suspense novels, and if you read her books, you'll see she's clearly a woman who takes inspiration from the journeys she makes. But as she tells it, the connection with Antarctica is about more than just inspiration. Helene, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you made your first trip, your trip to Antarctica, as part of a 26-day tour with a group of scientists. What drew you to that opportunity?
I think because my father had been a marine engineer and had done the Arctic Circle supply run many, many years ago before I was born, I always had an affinity with the what I think of as the Great Ice Areas. And because he'd never been to Antarctica, it was always on my tick list to go. And part of what drew me was the history, but also I knew that there was this immense continent down there that very few people had the privilege of setting foot on. So I wanted to go and put my footprints on Antarctica.
Fair enough. I love that ambition. So a 26-day tour surrounded by scientists. Were you the, do you have a scientific bone in your body, or were you there as the kind of creative presence?
Yeah, the ship was an exploration ship, but that meant there was 90 fair-paying passengers, if you like, and then this group of 26 scientists who, some of them were had done winters over with the Australian Antarctic Service down in the areas around Mawson's Hut. We were dropping off a scientist at Macquarie Island, and she simply, to get to Macquarie, had to go the whole way around. Too tough for her, wasn't it? Through the tour with us for us to drop her off at Macquarie. But part of the expedition was that while you're at sea and really in that sort of Great Southern Ocean, there's not a great deal of wildlife, so there's not a lot to necessarily see. So the scientists were delivering lectures on all their specialties, from the emperor penguins to the ice, to exploration down there, to the study of lichens. It was fascinating.
So before you even get there, obviously long haul travel on a ship is something that most of us don't experience. Tell us a bit about the supply ship.
Yeah, so they call the Maria Svetaeva. I can't even say that word correctly now, but she was a Russian icebreaker, and she'd been converted to carry passengers as well. She was 90 metres long, so she wasn't big by the standards of the ships that go down from places like Ushuaia to the top of Antarctica. And this is designed to go into that deeper ice area around McMurdo Sound. And you're on board. It's a very simple existence. It's not like you're there in one of those great big cruise liners. And while we didn't have to pitch in and help, you certainly, it was basic meal, but it was all very good quality, fresh food. And then on board the ship, you had a bunch of Zodiacs and 2 helicopters for when you got to Antarctica. So there was this sense of excitement the whole way from when you leave Bluff in New Zealand and start to thread your way south past the sub-Antarctic islands.
Are those supply ships very rough environments? I mean, are they very male environments? Not that you'd be any stranger to that, having been a pilot. But.
No, I'm quite used to working with blokes. But no, I mean, it was very much, you know, we were passengers on board the vessel as well. So it was being run as something that was an experience for the guests on board. And the scientists were there to assist in making that an extra special trip to Antarctica. So while it was relatively basic, it was still extremely comfortable. I didn't ever feel, having been on ships with my dad, and they were oil tankers, and they were very blokey environments. This didn't feel like that. This felt like we were being looked after. And the deck was open, so you could go up onto the bridge deck.
Describe that to me. I want to understand what it was like the first time you went out onto the deck.
Yeah, the first time we went up onto the bridge deck was amazing. The Russian captain was everything I would expect from a romance hero, bless him. Big bear of a man who you know, very gently spoken until he needed to say, shut up. Which he did on one occasion when we found ourselves trapped on ice. But that first moment when you go up on deck, you've left New Zealand, it's disappearing into the horizon, and you're looking across it at what's just an enormous expanse of water. And somewhere that, you know, as a sailor as well, I'm very conscious that the Southern Ocean can whip up in an instant and can take people's lives. So you're conscious that while you're in a relatively large ship, you're still at the mercy of the weather. And then the colour starts to leach out as you get further south from New Zealand. The sub-Antarctic islands still have some vegetation on them, and at that time of year it was the end of summer, so there's still colour, there's still animals, there's penguins, there's seals, and it's all still quite vibrant. And then as you keep to go further south, you're simply in something that becomes monochrome almost, because the water is so dark blue it's almost black, and the sky overhead at times, we had some beautiful days, but we also had a lot of overcast, and it's grey. And you just start, I think it almost starts to immerse you in what you're going to experience when you get to Antarctica.
So you're in this kind of monochromatic landscape.
Yeah.
It's funny, when we, for this segment, Sense of Place, we kick off this last part of the show normally with a piece of music from the place that people bring to us. And obviously in the case of Antarctica, we found ourselves trying to do justice to the question of silence, because from what I understand, it's just completely quiet.
That's right. So the first land stop after the sub-Antarctics is Cape Adare, and it itself is very noisy because there's a huge Adelie penguin colony on it, and you can hear them from the ship very, very clearly, and you're moored a fair way off, you can hear them. But as you get further in and you go to places like we went and visited one of the French bases, there was no wildlife there particularly. But I remember standing near one of the huts, and there weren't many other people around us, and you could hear the birds' wings. And the birds were several hundred feet above us, but you could literally hear the sound of the bird wing flapping. And that for me was, it was an almost overwhelming silence. You know, when you go west in Australia or east, if you're in Western Australia, if you see what I mean, but if you go into the centre of Australia, there is still a certain amount of life. There's still a certain amount of insect noise, and it's never entirely silent. Down there, it just, you could almost feel it pressing down on you. And for me, that was magic.
So I'm never afraid to go for a cliche, and I have to ask, you know, once you're out on the deck, talk to me about the cold.
Cold's freezing, yeah. It's very bitter. They equip you with a coat because it's, what most people don't realise is Antarctica is extremely dry. So the snow, it's so cold, the snow when it falls doesn't stick. It just brushes off. So the coat that you're wearing as the overproof is more of a wind chill factor deterrent, if you like. But it is bitingly cold. You're in your thermals, you're in a dozen layers, and you've got a scarf wrapped around your face. And for me, the historic side of it is trying to imagine what it must have been like for those early explorers going down there in little wooden ships in some cases, and even in some of the bigger vessels that people like Shackleton took. That must have just been bitter on the deck when you were doing a night watch, because I got to go back inside and warm my hands up on the heater and defrost my face. But it was that bone chilling coldness that I'd never experienced before. And having lived a fair bit of time in North Queensland, I'm a bit of a sook when it comes to the cold. So
fair enough too. I think a bit of sookiness is okay there. I'm interested though, you're a pilot, so seeing a barometer drop rapidly must be a fascinating fascinating
experience. And you know, I probably was the only person on the vessel. As we were coming back, we'd got caught in some bad weather, so we'd found ourselves trapped in the ice in McMurdo Sound because one of the helicopters had broken down. So instead of being able to transfer the 90 passengers quickly, it had taken a long time. The ship had got stuck. There was debate at one stage that we were going to actually have to get an icebreaker back to break us out. Captain persevered, but we then found ourselves a day and a half behind schedule and got caught in some fairly significant weather. Now, if you're in North Queensland and you see a cyclone and the barometer's coming down to about 990, you think, oh, it's going to be a bit breezy. If it gets to below 980, you know that you're in for a significant blow. If it gets below 970, you know, you're going to want to probably evacuate. And we're on the deck of this ship, which is pitching. Most people have gone to bed, but I was quite happy still being on the bridge deck hanging on, watching the barometer get down to 958. And if that was in North Queensland, you would expect to see towns ripped apart. And I guess because it's, you know, it's in an ocean, there is nothing for it to do other than build these monstrous waves, which were actually hitting the bridge deck windows. And, you know, the Russian crewmen, clearly it was something they just shrugged their shoulders and went, yeah, she'll be right. but for somebody like myself as a pilot, knowing exactly what that barometer reading meant, I had to take photographs of it to bring back and say, you won't believe I've been through this sort of weather system. But it was amazing.
Yeah.
And the violence of the ocean is pretty spectacular.
You mentioned the violence of the ocean like you're a sensible person, but I happen to know for a fact that sense left you at one point when you made a decision that it was a good idea to have a swim.
Well, they give you the option of diving in. And, you know, I'm my father's daughter. He'd been swimming in the Arctic Circle, so I kind of had to go down to Antarctica and dive in. I had envisaged that it would be in a lovely big calm area and we'd be off an ice floe and it would be all sunny. In fact, because of the weather pattern we ended up in, we were in the middle of the Southern Ocean before the waves had started to build, in amongst what's essentially a loose ice floe. So there's great big platelets of white ice bobbing around about the size of, around outside dinner setting, that sort of size table, and that's the size of the platelets of ice. So they got the dinghies down and they created a space for us to dive in. And I think there was 14 of us that were mad enough to actually do it. So you walk down the gangplank and you're just in your Speedos and you dive.
Mad doesn't do justice to that. You're not just mad, you are kind of
I do love my water. I do love my water butt. So, you know, and my husband was just rolling his eyes going, yep, she's going to do it. She's an idiot. But anyway, let her do it. But for me, it really was special. You've dived into the water and you're going down and the colour below you is a very rich, dark navy black. And then as you turn to look up and you're looking at all these floating, the undersides, all these floating white platelets, and you can see the propeller wash, which is white, but everything else is this incredible French navy blue. And you have this sense of which way do I want to go? And it's only for a split second because, believe me, it's cold. So you pretty rapidly work out which way is up. You get up, your head pops out, and the cold starts to really bite. At that stage, I think your body's in shutdown. And then the guys grab you, hauled you out.
Helene, it beggars belief that was a life-changing trip for you rather than a life-ending one. But I'm thrilled, and you have brought it to life for us today. Thank you so much for joining
us. My pleasure.
That's novelist and Queensland regional flying manager for QantasLink, Helene Young. Her latest novel, the very opposite of what we've discussed today, is called Northern Heat. It's published by Penguin. You're listening to Blueprint for Living with me, Michael Williams, on RN. Any observer of Australian food culture will have observed the waxing and waning curiosity about bush foods over the years. Over decades, many column inches in the food press have been filled with articles about the health, environmental and cultural benefits of eating native foods. They crop up in our restaurants, even occasionally in our supermarkets. But I think it's fair to say that the use of these ingredients is still far from mainstream. So what needs to change? Indigenous chef Mark Olive started his apprenticeship in the 1980s, and he's been on a journey of encouraging wider take-up of native ingredients. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for joining us. So tell us, in the 80s, when you tried to bring bush food and native ingredients into the kitchen, how was it received?
Look, it wasn't even thought of back then, but because of my uncles and aunt, I'm from the Bundjalung region of Northern Rivers of New South Wales, that I was introduced to these foods. And my mother grew up on a mission, lots of wattle seed there, lots of lemon myrtle, which is the home of the lemon myrtle and also the aniseed myrtle, and introduced at a young age, and it was great. And thanks, very generous. I did start my apprenticeship in the 70s, but...
I'll give you a decade. You're very boyish.
It's the emu oil. It works. It's an amazing sort of like area for bush food. So really, really pungent. Lots of black wattle seeds and stuff like that. I have a couple here. Michael, this is what the black wattle seeds looks like. And when you process, it's an amazing, amazing seed. And yes, it hasn't been embraced over the years and it's been a long time trying to get these, you know, out there. But when you roast that and actually put it in the oven... grind it into a mortar and pestle, smell that, and what do you think it smells like?
Oh, wow, it's got an extraordinary, almost a chocolatey kind of finish to it.
It's chocolate and coffee. And look, hundreds of types of wattle seeds in the country. You can only eat two, the black and the green. That's the black there, roasted, grind it down, and yes, it smells like coffee and chocolate and no caffeine in it. So
Mark,
really
it's amazing.
It is amazing.
Do you drink it? Do you
Yeah, look, you can make wattle chinos out of it. Great for making desserts if you don't want caffeine in it. Things like tiramisus or, you know, cakes, biscuits, wattle seed biscuits, Anzacs, anything like that.
But, Mark, you pick me up on the mistake of 80s and 70s. We're talking about many decades of, and before that, many generations of knowledge about these foods and these ingredients and how wonderful they can be. Why on earth would we be resistant? Why wouldn't we be using it more and more in everyday cooking?
I think people have a perception that Aboriginal food from shows gone by is you go and dig it out of the ground and eat it straight away. Well, totally wrong, and that perception has to change, you know. I think it's the way people look at our foods as well. Yes, kangaroos, emus are our coat of arms. Aboriginal people never named it their coat of arms. It was a Dreamtime part of their storytelling in totems. And the thing is that, you know, people need to be educated that kangaroo is great for you and it is really high in protein and iron as well. So we have to give these animals a name, you know, for our meats. We don't go to the butchers and ask for a kilo of sheep, pig or cow. We actually ask for the cut. So you effectively, you're disassociating yourself with what you're buying. You're not thinking about the animal.
It's a really interesting idea. I am curious about that association. People have that assumption that this is Aboriginal food, that the aboriginality of it, the fact that that's the tradition to which it belongs, kind of attaches a kind of ownership. Is this cultural reappropriation?
I think it's like, you know, it should be a respectful part of, you know, Aboriginal communities. And, you know, people who are looking into this should be mindful of that as well. Yes, look, you know, been a chef for 30-odd years now, haven't seen a lot of this stuff only up until the mid-90s that it has started to actually push forward with the commercial aspects of the foods. And, look, Indigenous people are growing it, but a lot of non-Indigenous people are growing it. And I think the cultural aspects should be, we should all be working together with this, not just one group specifically, but everybody on board, because this is a unique food. I work with chefs all around the world that see this as new food. Let's face it, we've all got a curry or a five spice in the cupboard, but we haven't got wattle seeds or lemon myrtles, stuff that's in our own backyard that we should be proud of, that we should be utilising. And, you know, it should be everyday food, but for some reason we've got this cringe factor in this country about eating this food, how we look at it. But I think, you know, it stems back from the whole cultural aspect of it as well and the Aboriginal issue in this country.
Moving away from that kind of failure of the cultural appropriation, as far as practicalities go, is there much farming of these ingredients? Is there much kind of deliberate cultivation to turn them into a market force?
Oh, look, there's a huge, you know, there's a huge push for it. But, you know, like I was saying before, a lot of non-Indigenous people are jumping on board with this, making a lot of money out of it. Asia is hoovering up all of our herbs and spices, things like the fruits also. But not only that, the lemon myrtles and all of those other things.
So
but I have a
can
few
I just
fruits.
Check that? So in the Asian market, it's more about the kind of leafy greens and the...
The leafy greens, things like the warrigal greens, the lemon myrtles, everything's for their soaps, sauces, creams, everything like that. What they're putting into beauty products, basically. But, you know, kangaroo, we send kangaroo 2 ton to Belgium basically every month and then it's distributed, yet we can't even push a third of it here. I have a desert lime here I'd like you to try.
I'll tell
it's
you what,
a fruit.
I'm on a winner here. This is... Can I just eat this?
You can eat that. It's very bitter, but it's really nice if you like bitter. Just to give you an idea of the fruits, the desert lime, that's a very, makes great marmalade. It's great to make sauces, but also great with seafoods. Here I have a muntry berry, grows in South Australia.
I tell you what, radio might be an audio medium, but people at home are missing out. I'm tasting some amazing things.
Yeah, the flavours through that desert lime, you're getting that lovely eucalyptus, but lime scent. You're going to try this muntry, and it's a lovely little fruit, and you're going to get an explosion of like a Granny Smith apple in your mouth, and then there's an aftertaste of cinnamon. So, again, a lot of our herbs and spices in Australia cross over in flavours, and that's what makes it so unique and so approachable for a lot of chefs that are looking at this stuff and thinking, wow, where can I get this?
Tell me, Mark, you ran a catering business for many years, and you've scaled that part of things down now to focus on promoting these ingredients?
Ingredients, but not only that, to develop product and, you know, to get it out there and to be accountable for this product as well. Like I said, a lot of non-Indigenous people are putting this stuff out there, but you're only getting 1% of whatever's in this product. A lot of people are getting cheated, which I find really offensive. The thing is, this product should be showcased. I do work with these communities that are making produce, you're getting 70% of, you know, whatever into sauces, creams, but like these herbs I'm giving you a smell of, these are 100% pure, and here I have a desert raisin. Have a smell of that, and even just try a little bit, you're going to get this acrid taste, but the thing is, extremely high in vitamin C and a great antioxidant as well, and I call this the stock of our Indigenous foods.
Mark, I am going to sit here and snack on all of this. I know you have to get out of here now, so thank you so much for giving us your time this morning. Mark Olive is an Indigenous chef and a promoter of native foods, and I tell you what, I am here just dining like a king. Thank you so much for your time, Mark.
Thanks, Michael.
Picking up on some of those themes, we're now joined in the studio by Nick David. Nick's a brand consultant and general manager with Interbrand, and he's done a fair amount of thinking about what makes certain practices and ingredients capture a wider public imagination. Nick, how does an ingredient become a sensation? Like, we think about kale or quinoa. We've all seen these ingredients that explode into kind of everywhere territory. Is that an organic process, or does that just is that the product of a hell of a lot of work?
It depends. It can come in either way. I think sometimes there's a trend that takes hold that people get on top of, and it just goes from there. Sometimes these things can be engineered, and obviously the business I work in is trying to engineer people to be interested in things and take things up. It's interesting listening to what's been talked about here. I think it feels to me like it's frustrating that we're here talking about why people haven't taken up these foods and why people aren't eating these native Australian foods that are clearly great, and we've tasted a few today. I think there are a few reasons behind that, and I think it's I think the cultural factor is really, really important. I think food and how we position certain foods, whether they're ingredients or meals or meal occasions, is all about the sort of the imagery and the benefits that we try and convey.
Before we move past it, though, I'm interested in the fact that a food hitting the big time is as much about a kind of concerted marketing push as it is about anything else. There's a piece in the Fairfax Media earlier this week about kale in particular, and the fact that it wasn't a chance thing that suddenly it was on all menus and in supermarkets and everything else. There were kale marketers who went out there and told us it was time to eat kale. Is it all that calculated, or do food trends ebb and flow naturally as well?
I think they ebb and flow. I think that sometimes there are times when people are more interested in health, and when health is top of mind culturally, at a macro level, things like superfoods become something that goes on the agenda. So I think there's a cafe around the corner from me that sells a superfood salad. And I think when I feel like I want to have that healthy meal, then it fits that occasion.
I get intimidated. I don't want a salad to be healthier than I am. Like, I want a kind of symbiotic relationship between the two. Is it health the answer? I mean, because a lot of work has been done with bush foods to kind of promote the way in which they have these great nutritional benefits. Is that one of the steps that you would recommend?
I think it's an avenue. It's clearly an avenue. I think there's much more to it than that, though. I think health is more or less a functional benefit of foods. I think there has to be some kind of imagery and association that goes with that, that has an impact on people, that people want to buy into. We need to, I think there are two things here. One is creating awareness, and one is, I think it's probably enough awareness, but it's not there quite yet. And we need to create desire. And I think the desire comes from, what does this mean to me? Why is this important? People love to go out for a Thai meal or an Indian curry, and I think it's because they feel they're tapping into something authentic and culturally rich for them and their friends.
So, like Mark, you said, essentially there's a cultural gap rather than anything else. Is there a supply and demand issue? Until people want it, it's not going to be in supermarkets, and if it's not in supermarkets, they don't know they want it?
Yeah, look, there's probably a bit of a cycle there where we have to try and break that somehow. The big supermarkets, they do dominate, so Woolworths and Coles, in terms of distribution, they can be fairly ruthless. They will take foods that sell, and they won't take foods that won't sell. I think there's probably some work that we can do at a high level, at a governmental level, to really try and encourage the people who can produce and do produce these foods to get them to the right distribution points.
Well, it sounds like there's quite a bit of work to be done to make it more part of our life, but you've given us a lot of, I'm going to say, food for thought, and I'm going to be full of self-loathing for it. I've been speaking with Nick Davis. He's a brand consultant. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that's all we have time for here on Blueprint this week. Thanks to our producers, Maria and Kathy, and today's technical producers, Angie and John. Next week on the show, we'll be asking if Aussie craft beers are being squeezed out by the big players. We're looking beneath the covers. No, there's got to be a better way of saying that. We're looking at book design, anyway, one way or the other, and we're finding out about the resurrection of an American travel guide tradition that dates back to the 1930s. Something old, something new. We'll see about the other ingredients when the time comes around. Bye.